speeches by leaders during wartime in modern times, broadcasted into our living rooms, having always pushed hard on this theme of an absolutely necessary mission, the high calling that justifies the killing. And paradoxically, authority can more readily project this take on reality for the very reason that conscience cherishes a high calling and a sense of membership in the right-minded group. In other words, conscience can be tricked, and when it comes to killing strangers, trickery is usually required. That psychology can provide the military with techniques to make killers out of non-killers, and that the military is using these procedures, is dispiriting news. But behind the bad news is a particle of hope that glints like a diamond in a sea of darkness. We are beginning to learn that human beings are not the natural killing machines we have at times believed ourselves to be. Even under the desperate pressures of combat, we have often left our weapons unfired or taken poor aim, for when it was not silenced under the bell jar of authority, there was always an outcry from our human connectedness. There has always been the voice of conscience, reminding us that we must not kill. Because its essence is killing, war is the ultimate contest between conscience and authority. Our seventh sense demands that we not take life, and when authority overrules conscience and a soldier is induced to kill in combat, he is very likely to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder immediately and for the remainder of his life, along with the depression, divorces, addictions, ulcers, and heart disease that attend traumatic memory. In contrast, research involving Vietnam veterans has shown that soldiers who are not placed in situations where they are forced to kill are no more likely to develop the symptoms of PTSD than are those who spent their entire enlistment at home. This crippling competition between our moral sense and our authority figures has gone on almost unceasingly since human beings began to live in hierarchical societies. For the past 5,000 years, during which a king or a land-hungry nobleman or the leader of a state or a nation could order less powerful individuals to enter a battle and kill. And apparently it is a struggle of conscience that will not be resolved in our children's or our grandchildren's lifetimes. Obedience 6, Conscience 4. Stanley Milgram, who demonstrated that at least 6 out of 10 people will tend to obey to the bitter end an official-looking authority who is physically present, pointed out that people who disobey destructive authority suffer psychologically too. Often a person who disobeys finds himself at odds with the social order and may find it hard to shake the feeling that he has been faithless to someone or something to whom he pledged allegiance. Obedience is passive, and it is only the disobedient one who must bear the burden of his action, to use Milgram's words. If courage is acting according to one's conscience despite pain or fear, then strength is the ability to keep conscience awake and in force, despite the demands of authorities to do otherwise. And strength is important, because in championing the various causes of conscience, the odds are against us. To illustrate, I propose an imaginary society of exactly 100 adults in a group that conforms precisely to known statistics. This means that in the 100 people in my hypothetical society, 4 are sociopathic. They have no conscience. Of the remaining 96 decent citizens, all of whom do have consciences, 62.5% will obey authority more or less without question, quite possibly the authority of one of the more aggressive and controlling sociopaths in the crowd. This leaves 36 people who have both conscience and the strength to bear the burdens of their actions, a little more than a third of the group. These are not impossible odds, but they are not easy ones either. And there is yet another challenge for the conscience-bound, which is that, strange as it seems, most of the sociopaths are invisible. Let us turn to that dilemma now, and the remarkable case of Doreen Littlefield. Chapter 4, The Nicest Person in the World. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect, warns Yvonne. Doreen glances in the rearview mirror and wishes for the billionth time that she were beautiful. Life would be so much easier. She appears pretty in the mirror this morning, rested and with all of her makeup on, but she knows that if she were not so skilled with the cosmetics, or if she were tired, she would look quite plain. She would look plain, like the unsophisticated girl from the sticks that she was, more as if she belonged milking a cow than in the driver's seat of this black BMW. She is only 34, and her skin still looks good, no lines yet, a little pale maybe. But her nose is slightly pointed, enough to be noticeable, and her straw-colored hair, her most problematic feature, stays dry and frizzled, no matter what she does to it. Luckily, her body is excellent. She looks away from the mirror and down at her light gray silk suit, conservative but form-fitting. Doreen's body is good, and even better, she knows just how to move. For a woman with a plain face, she is incredibly seductive. When she walks across a room, all the men in it watch. Remembering this, she smiles and starts the car. About a mile from her apartment, she realizes that she forgot to feed the damn Maltese. Oh well, the stupid frou-frou dog will manage to survive until she gets home from work tonight. At this point, a month after the impulse purchase, she cannot believe she ever bought it anyway. She had thought she would look elegant when she walked it, but walking it turned out to be tedious. When she can find the time, she will have to get it put to sleep, or maybe she can sell it to someone. It was expensive, after all. In her parking area on the sprawling grounds of the psychiatric hospital, she makes sure to park her car beside Jenna's rusted-out Escort, a convenient visual comparison to remind Jenna of their relative places in the world. One more glance in the mirror, and then Doreen picks up her briefcase, stuffed to overflowing to make it clear how hard she works, and walks up the stairs to the suite of offices above the ward. As she passes through the waiting room, she flashes a "We're good buddies" smile at Ivy, the frumpy secretary receptionist for the unit, and Ivy immediately brightens. "Good morning, Dr. Littlefield. Oh my goodness, I love your suit. It's just gorgeous." "Why, thank you, Ivy. I can always count on you to put me in a good mood," Doreen replies with another big smile. "Buzz me when my patient gets here, would you?" Doreen disappears into her office, and Ivy shakes her head and says out loud to an empty waiting room, "That has got to be the nicest person in the world." It is early, not quite 8 o'clock, and in her office, Doreen goes to the window to watch her colleagues arrive. She sees Jackie Rubenstein walking toward the building with her long legs and her effortless posture. Jackie is from Los Angeles, even-tempered and funny, and her beautiful olive skin makes her look always as if she just got back from a wonderful vacation. She is brilliant as well, a great deal smarter than Doreen, and for this reason, even more than the others, Doreen secretly despises her. In fact, she hates her so much that she would kill her if she thought she could get away with it, but she knows she would eventually get caught. Doreen and Jackie were postdocs together at the hospital 8 years ago, became friends, at least in Jackie's eyes, and now Doreen is hearing rumors that Jackie may receive the Mentor of the Year award. They are the same age. How can Jackie possibly win an award for being a mentor at the age of 34? From the lawn, Jackie Rubenstein looks up and notices Doreen in the office window. She waves. Doreen smiles girlishly and waves back. At this moment, Ivy buzzes Doreen for her first patient of the day, a stunningly handsome, broad-shouldered, but very frightened-looking young man named Dennis. In hospital lingo, Dennis is a VIP, very important patient, because he is the nephew of a famous national politician. In this major teaching hospital, there are a number of such VIPs, celebrities, the wealthy, family members of people whose names are household words. Dennis is not one of Doreen's psychotherapy patients. Rather, Doreen is his administrator, which means that she meets with him twice a week to inquire how his treatment is going, to make sure the paperwork is done, and to approve his discharge from the hospital when the time comes. Doreen has already heard from the staff that today Dennis will want to discuss his release. He thinks he has gotten better enough to go home. To separate the administrative tasks from the psychotherapeutic ones is hospital policy. Each patient has both an administrator and a therapist. Dennis's therapist, whom he worships, is the talented Dr. Jackie Rubenstein. Yesterday, Jackie told Doreen that her patient Dennis was tremendously improved and that she plans to take him on as an outpatient when he leaves the hospital. Now Dennis sits in one of the low chairs in Doreen Littlefield's office and tries to make eye contact, as he knows he should if he is going to appear well enough to go home from the hospital. But he has a hard time and keeps looking away. Something about her gray suit scares him, and something about her eyes. Still, he likes her, he thinks. She has always been extremely nice to him, and other people have told him that of all the doctors, Dr. Littlefield is the one who is most interested in the patients. Anyway, she is the expert. Doreen, seated behind her desk, looks at Dennis and marvels again at the perfect lines of his face and his muscular 26-year-old body. She wonders how much money he will end up inheriting, but then she remembers her mission and tries to lock in his nervous gaze with a maternal smile. I hear you've been feeling much better this week, Dennis.
That's right, Dr. Littlefield. I've been feeling much better this week. Really, a whole lot better. My ideas are much better. They're not bothering me all the time like they were when I came in.
Why do you think that is, Dennis? Why do you think they're not bothering you anymore?
Oh, well, I've really been working hard on the cognitive therapy techniques Dr. Rubenstein taught me, you know? They're okay. I mean, they help. And, well, the thing is, I think I'm ready to go home now. Or soon, maybe. Dr. Rubenstein said she could keep seeing me as an outpatient.
Dennis's ideas, the ones that are not bothering him so much at present, are the paranoid delusions that completely take over his life from time to time. Once a vibrant teenager who made stellar grades and was the champion of his high school lacrosse team, Dennis suffered a psychotic breakdown during his freshman year in college and was hospitalized. In the 7 years since then, he has been in and out of psychiatric facilities as his delusions waxed and waned, but never really left him. When these terrifying ideas have him in their grip, he believes that people are trying to kill him and lying about their intentions, that the streetlights are monitoring his thoughts for the CIA, that every passing car contains an agent who has been sent to abduct and question him for crimes that he cannot remember. His sense of reality is fragile in the extreme, and the torment of his suspiciousness, which is present even when the concrete delusions are in remission, makes it increasingly difficult for him to be around other people, even therapists. Jackie Rubenstein has done an almost miraculous job of forging a therapeutic relationship with this lonely young man who trusts no one.
You say Dr. Rubenstein said you could be discharged and that she'd see you as an outpatient?
Yes. Yes, that's what she suggested. I mean, she agreed that I was almost ready to go home.
Really? Doreen looks at Dennis with a puzzled expression on her face, as if expecting some clarification.
That's not what she told me.
There is a long pause, during which Dennis shudders visibly. Finally, he asks, "What do you mean?" Doreen emits a staged sigh, full of compassion, and comes out from behind her desk to sit in the chair beside Dennis's. She tries to put her hand on his shoulder, but he pulls his body away from her, as if she were about to strike him. Staring out the window as far into the distance as he can, he repeats his question. What do you mean that's not what she told you? Doreen understands enough about paranoid schizophrenia to know that Dennis already suspects this is going to be news of treachery on the part of Dr. Rubenstein, the person he thought was his only real friend in the world.
What Dr. Rubenstein told me was that she was sure you were much sicker now than when you came in. And as for outpatient therapy, she made it very clear that she'd never agree to see you outside of the hospital. She said you were much too dangerous.
Even to Doreen, it is apparent that something in Dennis's heart is flying out of the window in a way, not to return to him anytime soon. She says, "Dennis? Dennis, are you okay?" Dennis does not move or speak. She tries again. I'm so sorry I had to be the one to tell you this. Dennis, I'm sure it was just a misunderstanding. You know Dr. Rubenstein would never lie to you. But Dennis is silent. He has to cope with the fear of betrayal every minute of his life, but this huge new wave of it, coming from his wonderful Dr. Rubenstein, has blindsided him and made him stone still like a statue. When Doreen realizes that he really is not going to respond at all, she goes to the phone and calls for assistance. In no time, two burly mental health workers appear at her office door. They are big, but she is the authority, and they will obey her orders without question. Thinking this gives her a little shiver of pleasure, but wearing her gravest expression, she signs the order to board Dennis. Boarding, a euphemism that makes it sound like the hospital is putting someone up at an inn, means that a patient is transferred from an unlocked ward, such as the one Dennis has been to a locked unit with greater security. Patients are boarded if they become violent, or when, like Dennis, they have had a serious relapse. If necessary, they are restrained and remedicated.
Doreen is fairly certain that Dennis will not tell anyone about what she has just said to him. Dennis does not tell his secrets. He's too paranoid. But even if he does tell someone, he will not be believed. No one ever believes the patients over the doctors, and from what she just saw, he will be out of it for quite a long time, and not really talking about anything. With a rush of satisfaction, she realizes that Jackie Rubenstein has just lost herself one truly delectable VIP patient. He will be wildly paranoid about Jackie now, and the best part is that Jackie will blame herself, will think she missed something important in her therapy with him, or said something harmful. Jackie is such a loser about things like that. She will actually take the rap, and then she will hand the patient off to another therapist. So much for all the talk around the hospital about Dr. Rubenstein being a miracle worker. Blue smoke and mirrors. Doreen Littlefield is what personality theorist Theodore Millon would call a covetous psychopath, where psychopath refers to sociopathy, or the absence of conscience, and covetous has its usual referent, an inordinate desire for the possessions of others. Sociopaths do not always have a covetous nature. Some are very differently motivated. But when lack of conscience and covetousness occur together in the same individual, a fascinating and frightening picture emerges. Since it is simply not possible to steal and have for oneself the most valuable possessions of another person, beauty, intelligence, success, a strong character, the covetous sociopath settles for besmirching or damaging enviable qualities in others, so that they will not have them either, or at least not be able to enjoy them so much. As Millen says, here the pleasure lies in taking rather than in having. The covetous sociopath thinks that life has cheated her somehow, has not given her nearly the same bounty as other people, and so she must even the existential score by robbing people, by secretly causing destruction in other lives. She believes she has been slighted by nature, circumstances, and destiny, and that diminishing other people is her only means of being powerful. Retribution, usually against people who have no idea that they have been targeted, is the most important activity in the covetous sociopath's life, her highest priority. Since this clandestine power game is priority number one, all of the covetous sociopath's deceitfulness and tolerance for risk are devoted to it. For the sake of the game, she may devise schemes and perform acts that most of us would consider outrageous and potentially self-destructive, in addition to cruel. And yet, when such a person is around us in our lives, even on a daily basis, we are often oblivious to our activities. We do not expect to see a person direct a dangerous, vicious vendetta against someone who, in most cases, has done nothing to hurt or offend her. We do not expect it, and so we do not see it, even when it happens to someone we know, or to us personally. The actions taken by the covetous sociopath are often so outlandish and so gratuitously mean that we refuse to believe they were intentional, or even that they happened at all. In this way, her true nature is usually invisible to the group. She can easily hide in plain sight, as Doreen has done among genuinely intelligent, professional people at the hospital for nearly a decade. The covetous sociopath is the ultimate wolf in sheep's clothing, and in Doreen's case, the disguise is especially elaborate. Doreen is a psychologist, or at any rate, everyone at the hospital believes she is a psychologist, which for Doreen Littlefield's purposes is much the same thing. The truth, should anyone ever discover it, is that she has no psychology license, nor does she have a doctoral degree. When she was 22, she did receive a bachelor's degree in psychology from her state university back home, but that is all. The rest is an extravagant charade. When they hired her as a postdoc at the hospital, they checked her references, but these were both very prominent men who had succumbed to certain embarrassing liaisons with her, though they should have known better. The hiring committee did not check the credentials she listed. Because she came so prestigiously recommended, they simply assumed she had a PhD. After all, who on earth would lie about a thing like that? As for her ability to behave like a psychologist well enough to fool the professionals and the patients, Doreen has always felt, and apparently she is borne out in this opinion, that a person can learn a lot by reading books. Doreen has just seen her recovering 8 o'clock patient, drop-kicked him into an acutely paranoid state as retribution against an innocent colleague, and sent him off to be medicated and confined to a locked unit. What does she do for the remainder of the day? If we were to rejoin her in her office, we would find that she calmly meets with the rest of her scheduled patients, makes phone calls, does paperwork, and goes to a staff meeting. We would probably not see anything out of the ordinary. Most of her behavior would look normal to us, or close enough to pass. Perhaps she does not do her patients very much good, but she does them no obvious harm either, except in those instances like this morning when manipulating a patient will serve to damage a colleague she has targeted. Why would she direct her skills against psychiatric inpatients? They have nothing she wants. They are disenfranchised by the world, and she can feel powerful merely by sitting in a room with them. The exception might be the occasional female patient who is a little too attractive, or worse, a little too smart. Then Doreen might have to bring her down a peg or two, tweak a bit of the self-hatred that is usually already there in these patients. In her role as a psychotherapist, she finds this ridiculously easy to do. The setup is always one-on-one, and the patient never understands what hit her well enough to complain to anyone outside of the therapy room. But when people do not provoke in Doreen a desire for something they have, or for something they are, then she does not target them. To the contrary, she may be especially charming and courteous when she believes that certain underlings, as she thinks of them, are useful in maintaining her sheep's clothing disguise, a disguise that includes a presentation of herself as an extraordinarily nice, caring, responsible, and pitiably overworked person. For example, when Doreen is preparing to leave work on the day she has secretly sabotaged Jackie Rubenstein and Dennis, she makes sure to stop by Ivy's desk for an endearing little chat. She tries to do this every evening. Ivy is the secretary receptionist for the professionals on the ward, and one never knows when such a strategically placed person may come in handy. Doreen comes out of her office, collapses into one of the reception room chairs, and says, "Oh, Ivy, I'm so grateful this day is over." Ivy is 20 years older than Doreen. She is overweight and wears big plastic earrings. Doreen thinks she is pathetic. Ivy replies to her warmly, "I know, you poor thing. And that poor Dennis. I'm no doctor, but I do see the patients around, you know. And I sort of had my hopes up. I guess I was wrong." No, you're very observant. He did seem better for a while. This work breaks your heart sometimes." Of course, this morning the two no-nonsense attendants carrying Dennis off the ward passed right in front of a wide-eyed Ivy. She now looks at Doreen with concern. "You know, Dr. Littlefield, I worry about you." As Ivy makes this confession, she notices that Doreen's eyes are pooling with tears, and she continues in a lower voice, "Oh my, today was terrible for you, wasn't it, dear? I hope you won't think I'm getting too personal, but you're so sensitive to be doing this kind of work." No, Ivy, I'm just tired. And of course I'm sad about Dennis. Don't tell anyone, I'm not supposed to play favorites, but he's special to me, you know. I wish I could just go home and get a good night's sleep."
"Well, that's exactly what you should do, dear."
"I wish I could, but what with the emergency and all, I didn't get my paperwork done. And I think I'm going to be up half the night doing it." Ivy glances at Doreen's bulging briefcase and says, "You poor thing. Let's think of something nice, maybe, to get your mind off, well, what happened today. How's that new Maltese doggy of yours?" Doreen blots her eyes with the back of her hand and smiles. "Oh, he's terrific, Ivy. Actually, sometimes he's so cute I could just eat him up." Ivy chuckles. "Well, then, I'll bet he's waiting for you. Why don't you go on home now and give him a great big hug?" "Better not be too big. I'll squish him. He's teeny." The two women laugh over this, and then Doreen says, Ivy, you know, I think you should be the psychologist. You always know how to put me in a better mood. I'll see you bright and early tomorrow, okay? We'll just keep on keeping on, I guess." "I'll be here," affirms Ivy. She beams as Doreen picks up her briefcase and walks away, listing a bit to the briefcase side. Doreen walks back to the lot where she left her car, and there she encounters Jenna, owner of the beat-up Escort she parked beside this morning. Jenna is a new intern at the hospital, and, unlike Ivy the receptionist, she is young, bright, and pretty. She has long, lovely, stick-straight auburn hair, and Doreen has targeted her. Hello, Jenna. Going home? Jenna blinks at the obvious question, which she thinks is probably criticism, since interns are expected to work slavishly long hours, but she recoups. Yeah, yes, going home. You too? Doreen looks concerned. What about that emergency conference at Chatwin Hall? Chatwin House houses a ward directed by the stern and fearsome Dr. Thomas Larson, whom Doreen knows to be Jenna's primary supervisor. There is, of course, no conference there right now. Doreen has made this up on the spot. Jenna turns ashen immediately. There's an emergency conference? Nobody told me. When? Why? Do you know? Doreen, now taking on the demeanor of a schoolmarm, looks at her watch and says, About 10 minutes ago, I believe. Didn't you pick up your phone messages? Yes, of course I did, but there really wasn't anything about a conference. Dr. Larson's office? I suppose. Oh, no. Oh, my God. I guess I'll just get there as fast as I can. Good idea. Jenna is too panicked to wonder why Dr. Littlefield knows about a spur-of-the-moment conference that does not even involve her. The young intern dashes out of the parking lot and begins to run in her leather pumps across an acre of rain-soaked hospital lawn. Doreen stands in the parking lot and watches her go, until, still sprinting, she makes a turn around the far side of a building and disappears from view. Reflecting in satisfaction that Chatwin Hall is located on the extreme opposite end of the grounds, Doreen gets into the BMW, checks her makeup in the rearview mirror, and starts for home. Tomorrow, or the next day, she will come across Jenna again, and Jenna will ask her about the conference that did not exist. Doreen will just shrug and look hard into Jenna's soft eyes, and Jenna will back off. Sociopathy versus criminality. Doreen Littlefield will never be prosecuted for her deeds, including practicing psychology without a license. Dennis's influential uncle will never discover who she really is, nor will most of her other patients or their families. The professionals of the hospital will never pursue her legally for her criminal deception of them. She will never be punished in anything like a commensurate way for the countless psychological assaults she commits. In the end, she is a good illustration of the difference between a sociopath and a criminal, which is, astoundingly, the same thing that separates a naughty 3-year-old girl who is seen as well-behaved from one who is scolded for taking candy from her mother's purse. The difference, quite simply, is whether or not she gets caught. An adult's getting caught for committing acts without conscience is apparently more the exception than the rule. Since 4% of the entire population is sociopathic, one might reasonably think that our prison system is filled to overflowing with sociopaths, to the exclusion of other types of people. But this is not the case. According to Robert Hare and other researchers who test convicts, on average, only about 20% of prison inmates in the United States are sociopaths. Hare and others are careful to note that this 20% of the prison population accounts for more than 50% of the most serious crimes, extortion, armed robbery, kidnapping, murder, and crimes against the state, treason, espionage, terrorism. But the actual sociopathic head count in prisons, for both men and women, is only about 2 in 10. Put differently, most identified criminals are not sociopaths. Rather, they are people with more normal underlying personalities, whose behavior is the product of negative social forces, such as the drug culture, child abuse, domestic violence, and cross-generational poverty. The statistics mean also that very few sociopathic crimes are ever brought to the attention of our legal system, that very few sociopaths are criminals in the formal sense. The most common sociopathic profile, like Doreen's, involves ongoing deception and camouflage, and only the most flagrant crimes, kidnapping, murder, and so forth, are difficult for a reasonably intelligent sociopath to conceal. Some, by no means all, of the sociopathic armed robbers and kidnappers get caught. The Doreen Littlefields of the world seldom do, and even when they do get caught, in the sense of being found out, they are rarely prosecuted. The result is that most sociopaths are not incarcerated. They are out here in the world with you and me. In the next chapter, we will discuss the many reasons why people of conscience have so much difficulty seeing and dealing effectively with people who have no conscience.
These reasons range from the fear tactics used by sociopaths to our own misplaced sense of guilt. But first, let us return to the hospital once more, this time to see Dr. Jackie Rubenstein's miracle. Two miracles, in fact. It is now 4 days after Dennis was boarded to a locked unit, a Sunday, and the hospital grounds are empty except for a small car that travels up the narrow drive to Dennis's building and stops by the front door. Dr. Rubenstein steps out and digs in her coat pocket for the tremendous, almost medieval master key that will let her both in and out of the three-story stone building. Even now, after 8 years of work at the hospital, she clutches the heavy passkey in her hand rather than putting it back in her pocket after she enters a unit like this one and hears the door locked behind her. She has come to try one more time to get her terrified patient, Dennis, to talk to her. When she walks onto the ward itself, and yet another metal door closes behind her and locks, she sees Dennis sitting on a green vinyl sofa and staring at a television that has not been turned on. He looks up, their eyes meet for a moment, and to her surprise and relief, he motions for her to come and sit down. Then the first miracle happens. Dennis talks. He talks and he talks. And he tells Jackie Rubenstein everything Doreen Littlefield said. And the second miracle is that Jackie believes him. From home that night, she phones Doreen and confronts her. Doreen denies everything and disdainfully accuses her of being drawn into her patient's paranoia. When Jackie refuses to back down, Doreen warns her that she will be damaging her own career if she goes to anyone else at the hospital with such a wild tale. When she hangs up the phone after talking with Doreen, Jackie calls a good friend back in Los Angeles for support. She tells him, only half-kidding, that she thinks she may be losing her mind. Jackie does not know that Doreen is a fraud, and so from Jackie's perspective, she and Doreen are peers at the hospital. For this reason, Jackie realizes that she will have a hard time pressing her point with the more senior staff. They will assume this is just some kind of dispute between her and Jackie. At worst, like Doreen, they may suggest she is letting her patient's issues become her own. Nonetheless, on the following morning, she walks into the office of the director of her unit and tells him what has happened. His gray-bearded face reddens, which Jackie finds curious, since he does not seem to be angry, either at her or at Doreen. She wonders, as she has wondered vaguely before, whether he and Doreen have had an affair. After he hears Jackie out, the director does not take quite the disdainful approach Doreen did on the phone, but he does respectfully remind Jackie of how easy it is to see elements of credibility in the delusions of intelligent paranoids. He says he very much doubts that anything Dennis told her actually happened, and he expresses the hope that she and Doreen will not carry this disagreement out indefinitely. Such a rift would be bad for the unit. And so, in all important respects, Doreen gets away with what she has done, as usual. The happier news is that Dennis's therapy with Jackie is not permanently disrupted, and he is soon discharged from the hospital. The end of Doreen Littlefield's charade eventually comes, as it so often does for covetous sociopaths, not with a bang, but a whimper, and instigated by someone outside of the system. In Doreen's case, the successful whistleblower is a consumer advocate who appears twice a month on a local television show called Buyer Beware. 6 years after Doreen's psychological assault on Dennis, this local celebrity's wife is hospitalized for depression, and completely by chance, Doreen is assigned as her therapist. Rankled because he believes his wife's therapy is somehow mucking up his marriage, he uses his expertise to investigate Dr. Littlefield and readily discovers what she is, or rather, what she is not. He at once approaches the business director of the hospital and explains that if the hospital will kick Doreen out immediately, find a new therapist for his wife, and forgive his wife's entire hospital bill, he will not expose Doreen and the hospital on television. He points out quite reasonably that forgiving one bill is a lot less expensive than paying back the hundreds of bills, or worse, that will be brought against the hospital should Doreen's credentials, or the lack thereof, be broadcasted. Reading the file he has shown, the business director is clear on the concept right away, and on her 40th birthday, in the middle of eating cake at a little office party organized by Ivy, Doreen is abruptly summoned to the administration building. In the business director's office, the business director, the medical director, and the director of nursing,
who wants to be present just because she hates Doreen so much, inform Doreen that security will escort her to her car and then monitor her to make certain she leaves the hospital grounds. Doreen tells the three directors that they are making a big mistake, that the consumer advocate is lying because he does not like her, and that she will sue them. She drives away, and though she was there for 14 years, no one at the hospital ever hears from her again. The hospital administration does not pursue the matter for the obvious reasons of public embarrassment and medical liability, and there is a collective sigh of relief when she simply vanishes. In their private conversations about her, the director of nursing and Jackie Rubenstein speculate that Doreen is somewhere else, in some other state, still practicing psychology. Most of the people at the hospital have vast quantities of conscience, and so why, when they finally find out about Doreen, do they let her go without a fight, most likely to strike again somewhere else? And why, in a psychiatric hospital, was she so hard to see in the first place? In general, how can any of us live, as we all do, among significant numbers of destructive liars and con artists, and fail to confront them, or even notice them? As we are about to see, there are answers to these crucial questions, and also ways we can begin to change our responses to the slippery phenomenon of sociopathy. Chapter 5. Why Conscience is Partially Blind. It is easy, terribly easy, to shake a man's faith in himself. To take advantage of that, to break a man's spirit, is devil's work. George Bernard Shaw. If she had thought she could get away with it, Doreen Littlefield would have run Jackie Rubenstein down with her BMW rather than merely sabotaging her work. And, more amazing still, if she had crushed or killed Jackie or anyone else, Doreen would have experienced no guilt or remorse, much less the horror most of us would feel if we ended another person's life. Her blood pressure would not have risen one point, at least not from any negative emotion having to do with the victim. Doreen has no such sense of things, no seventh sense of human connectedness to make her feel sick over the consequences of her actions. For most of us, killing someone would result in shock, followed by life-altering anguish, even if we had not liked that person. For Doreen, such an act, provided she was never caught, would be experienced as winning. This difference between normal emotional functioning and sociopathy is almost too fantastic for those of us with conscience to grasp, and so for the most part, we refuse to believe such a hollowness of emotion can exist. And unfortunately, our difficulty in crediting the magnitude of this difference places us in peril. Even without murdering anyone with her car, or her own two hands, Doreen causes untold damage to the people around her. In fact, diminishing other lives is her primary goal. Since she uses the authority trappings of an inpatient psychotherapist, one day, as a side effect of the vengeful campaigns she conducts, she may push a patient into suicide, if she has not done so already. And yet for 14 years, a large group of good people, the members of an entire psychiatric hospital staff who would spend their last ounce of strength attempting to prevent a patient's suicide, are blind to what she is. And when they discover her deception, they do not try to stop her. They simply watch her drive away. Why are conscience-bound human beings so blind? And why are they so hesitant to defend themselves and the ideals and people they care about from the minority of human beings who possess no conscience at all? A large part of the answer has to do with the emotions and thought processes that occur in us when we are confronted with sociopathy. We are afraid, and our sense of reality suffers. We think we are imagining things, or exaggerating, or that we ourselves are somehow responsible for the sociopath's behavior. But before we discuss in detail our own psychological reactions to shamelessness, allow me to put these reactions in context by clearly describing what we are up against. Let us first take a careful look at the formidable techniques used by the shameless to keep us in line. The tools of the trade. The first such technique is charm, and, as a social force, charm should not be underestimated. Doreen could be extremely charming when it suited her purposes. Our old friend Skip used his considerable charm to influence his business associates and to grease the fast track to corporate dominance.
And charm, though the link may seem counterintuitive, is a primary characteristic of sociopathy. The intense charm of people who have no conscience, a kind of inexplicable charisma, has been observed and commented on by countless victims and by researchers who attempt to catalog the diagnostic signs of sociopathy. It is a potent characteristic. Most of the victims I have known in my work have reported that their initial involvement with a sociopathic person and their continued association, even though he or she caused them pain, was a direct result of how charming she or he could be. Countless times I have watched people shake their heads and make statements such as, "He was the most charming person I ever met," or, "I felt like I'd known her forever," or, "He had an energy about him that other people just don't have." I liken sociopathic charm to the animal charisma of other mammals who are predators. We watch the large cats, for example, and are fascinated with their movements, their independence, and their power. But the direct gaze of a leopard, should one happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, is inescapable and tetanizing. And the fascinating charm of the predator is often the last thing the prey ever experiences. I speak of noble leopards, but I have heard abused and enraged victims use metaphors that were decidedly reptilian. Enhancing the animal charisma of sociopaths, there is our own mild affinity for danger. Conventional wisdom has it that dangerous people are attractive, and when we are drawn to sociopaths, we tend to prove out this cliché. Sociopaths are dangerous in many ways. One of the most conspicuous is their preference for risky situations and choices, and their ability to convince others to take risks along with them. On occasion, but only on occasion, normal people enjoy minor risks and thrills. We will get out our wallets and pay for a ride on a monster roller coaster we cannot imagine surviving, or for a seat in a movie theater showing a bloody thriller we are certain will give us bad dreams. Our normal affinity for the occasional thrill can make the risk-taking sociopath seem all the more charming at first. Initially, it can be exciting to be invited into the risky scheme, to be associated with the person who is making choices outside of our ordinary boundaries. Let us take your credit card and fly to Paris tonight. Let us take your savings and start that business that sounds so foolish, but with two minds like ours, could really take off. Let us go down to the beach and watch the hurricane. Let us get married right now. Let us lose these boring friends of yours and go off somewhere by ourselves. Let us have sex in the elevator. Let us invest your money in this hot tip I just got. Let us laugh at the rules. Let us walk into this restaurant dressed in our t-shirts and jeans. Let us see how fast your car can go. Let us live a little. Such is the flavor of sociopathic spontaneity and risk-taking and charm. And though we may chuckle about the obvious come-ons when we read them, the overall approach has met with noteworthy success time and again. Someone who is unfettered by conscience can easily make us feel that our lives are tediously rule-bound and lackluster, and that we should join him in what is typically represented as a more meaningful or exhilarating form of existence. Beginning with Eve and the Serpent, our history books and our classic fiction are filled with tales of people who have been taken in and sometimes destroyed by the slick talk and magnetism of risk-takers and evildoers. Dickie Greenleaf and the Talented Mr. Ripley, Samson and Delilah, River City and Harold Hill, Trilby and Svengali, Norman Mailer and Jack Henry Abbott, Empress Alexandra and the seemingly immortal Rasputin. And from our own lives, we have memories of brushes with such people that send little cold chills up our spines. That is, if we are lucky, we have had only brushes. The unfortunate must live with the indelible memories of outright personal catastrophes that occurred when they fell victim to the charm of the shameless. Moreover, the shameless know us much better than we know them. We have an extremely hard time seeing that a person has no conscience. But a person who has no conscience can instantly recognize someone who is decent and trusting. Even as a child, Skip knew which boy he could talk into acquiring his fireworks for him. As an adult, he immediately perceived that Juliet could live with him for decades and never question his florid activities. Doreen Littlefield saw an easy mark in Ivy, the receptionist, and understood perfectly well that Jackie Rubenstein was a caring person who could be counted on to assume more than her fair share of responsibility. When a sociopath identifies someone as a good game piece, she studies that person. She makes it her business to know how that person can be manipulated and used, and to this end, just how her chosen pawn can be flattered and charmed. In addition, she knows how to promote a sense of familiarity or intimacy by claiming that she and her victim are similar in some way. Victims often recall statements that affected them even after the sociopath was gone, such as, "You know, I think you and I are a lot alike," or, "It's so clear to me that you're my soulmate." In retrospect, these remarks can feel supremely demeaning. Outrageously untrue, they haunt the mind nonetheless. Relatedly, people without conscience have an uncanny sense of who will be vulnerable to a sexual overture, and seduction is another very common sociopathic technique. For most people, a sexual liaison involves an emotional tie, even if only fleetingly, and such ties are used by the coldly remorseless to get what they want: allegiance, financial support, information, a sense of winning, or perhaps just a temporary relationship that has the appearance of being normal. This is an easily recognized story, and another one that repeats itself often in our literature and history. But seldom do we recognize the degree of power it bestows on sociopaths, power over individuals, of course, and also over groups of people and institutions. A sociopath who is hiding out in an organization can have his or her tracks hidden indefinitely by just one or two normal individuals who have made the single mistake of consummating their attraction to this charmingly dangerous person. Doreen, for example, was able to pose as a psychologist primarily because letters of reference were written by two people she had manipulated sexually. And when Jackie tried to expose Doreen's sociopathic behavior, a third person, the unit director, ran interference, probably for the same reason. And the seductive Dr. Littlefield remained at the hospital for 6 additional years. And sexual seduction is only one aspect of the game. We are seduced as well by the acting skills of the sociopath. Since the scaffolding of a life without conscience is deception and illusion, intelligent sociopaths often become proficient at acting, and even at some of the particular techniques employed by professional actors. Paradoxically, the visible signs of emotion at will can become second nature to the cold-blooded. The appearance of intense interest in another person's problems or enthusiasms, chest-thumping patriotism, righteous indignation, blushing modesty, weepy sadness. Crocodile tears at will are a sociopathic trademark. Making sure that Ivy would see and be psychologically seduced by them, Doreen cried crocodile tears over her patient Dennis, and no doubt she cried them in front of Ivy again, profusely, when she inevitably made up the terrible, painful illness that forced her to have her little dog put to sleep. Crocodile tears from the remorseless are especially likely when a conscience-bound person gets a little too close to confronting a sociopath with the truth. A sociopath who is about to be cornered by another person will turn suddenly into a piteous, weeping figure whom no one in good conscience could continue to pressure. Or the opposite. Sometimes a cornered sociopath will adopt a posture of righteous indignation and anger in an attempt to scare off her accuser, as Doreen did with the hospital directors when she was finally fired. Being natural actors, conscienceless people can make full use of social and professional roles, which constitute excellent ready-made masks that other people are loath to look behind. Roles help us organize our complex society, and they are tremendously important to us. If we see suspicious behavior, we may eventually question someone named Doreen Littlefield, but we are quite unlikely to question someone called Dr. Doreen Littlefield, no matter how unusual her behavior. We relate to the title of doctor, which holds a clear and positive meaning for us, and we do not think too hard about the human being who calls herself that.
To some extent, the same is true for people who have, legally or illegally, assumed roles and titles in the arenas of leadership, business, organized religion, education, or parenthood. Seldom do the neighbors scrutinize the behavior of the church deacon or the town selectman or the high school principal or a business prodigy like Skip. We believe promises from such people because we assign to the individual the integrity of the role itself. In like fashion, we almost never challenge a neighbor's parenting practices, even when we fear that a child is being abused, and often our logic is no more substantial than, he's the parent. In addition, we are distracted from a person's actual behavior when he represents himself as in some way benevolent, creative, or insightful. We do not suspect people who claim to be animal lovers, for example. We give extra leeway to those who identify themselves as artists or intellectuals, in part because we attribute any departures from the norm to eccentricities we, as ordinary people, could not possibly understand. In general, our regard for such groups is a constructive sentiment, but it does sometimes open the door for sociopaths who can mimic the others. Worse, our respect for people who appear to be inspired and benevolent leaders can be abused, has been abused many times, to cataclysmic ends. With a leader, especially one who claims to have a sublime mission, as with a doctor or a priest or a parent, we tend to bestow the qualities of the role on the individual and to follow the individual accordingly. Benjamin Wolman, founder and editor of the International Journal of Group Tensions, writes, "Usually, human cruelty increases when an aggressive sociopath gains an uncanny, almost hypnotic control over large numbers of people. History is full of chieftains, prophets, saviors, gurus, dictators, and other sociopathic megalomaniacs who managed to obtain support and incited people to violence. Insidiously, when such a savior abducts the normal population to his purposes, he usually begins with an appeal to them as good people who would like to improve the condition of humanity, and then insists that they can achieve this by following his own aggressive plan. In a confusing irony, conscience can be rendered partially blind, because people without conscience use, as weapons against us, many of the fundamentally positive tools we need to hold society together. Empathic emotions, sexual bonds, social and professional roles, regard for the compassionate and the creative, our desire to make the world a better place, and the organizing rule of authority. And people who do hideous things do not look like people who do hideous things. There is no face of evil. If we could somehow subtract all its horrifying connotations, the actual face of Saddam Hussein looks rather avuncular and has often been recorded as having a big friendly smile. Hitler's face, had it not become an icon of evil because of the atrocities his life engendered, might be considered almost comical, Chaplin-esque, as it were, in its foolish expression. Lizzie Borden looked like all the other laced-up Victorian ladies in Fall River, Massachusetts. Pamela Smart is pretty. Ted Bundy was so handsome that women sent marriage proposals to him on death row. And for every leering Charles Manson, there is the radiantly innocent countenance of a John Lee Malvo. We try, consciously or tacitly, to judge a person's character by his or her appearance, but this book by its cover strategy is ineffective in nearly all cases. In the real world, the bad guys do not look the way they are supposed to. They do not resemble werewolves or Hannibal Lecter or Tony Perkins staring at a corpse in a rocking chair. On the contrary, they look like us. Gaslight. Being targeted by a sociopath is a very frightening experience, even when that sociopath is not of the violent variety. In 1944, George Cukor directed a psychological thriller entitled Gaslight, in which a beautiful young woman, played by Ingrid Bergman, is made to feel she is going insane. Her fear that she is losing her mind is inflicted on her systematically by Charles Boyer, who plays her evil but charming new husband. Among a number of other dirty tricks, Boyer arranges for Bergman to hear sounds in the attic when he is absent, and for the gaslight to dim by itself in a menacing house where her aunt was mysteriously murdered years before. Of course, no one believes Bergman about the noises in the attic or the gaslight or much of anything else,
and her gradual descent into doubting her own reality has found its way into English idioms as to be gaslighted. Boyer is not violent. He never strikes Bergman. Much more sinister, he causes her to lose faith in her own perceptions. To suspect and to try to explain to others that one has been targeted by a sociopath is to be gaslighted. Jackie Rubinstein was a good example of this phenomenon when she confronted Doreen Littlefield with the cruelty she had done to Dennis. Afterward, Jackie phoned a friend for support because she felt she was losing her mind. And when she tried to relate her discovery about Doreen to the unit director, he politely but clearly echoed Doreen's implication that Jackie had gone a little crazy, along with her paranoid patient. When Jackie accused Doreen of a vicious act toward an unoffending patient, the natural question was, why would a person like that do such a horrible thing? This is the question that others always ask, overtly or by intimation, and it is such a bewildering, unanswerable question that the one who suspects the sociopath usually ends up asking it too, only to find that she has no rational-sounding explanation. And like the innocent new bride in Gaslight, she may come to lose faith, partially or completely, in her own perceptions. Certainly, she will hesitate to tell her story again, since trying to expose the sociopath casts doubt on her own credibility, and maybe even on her sanity. These doubts, our own and other people's, are painful and readily convince us to keep our mouths shut. Over the years, listening to hundreds of patients who have been targeted by sociopaths, I have learned that within an organization or a community, in the event that a sociopath is finally revealed to all and sundry, it is not unusual to find that several people suspected all along, each one independently, each one in silence. Each one felt gaslighted, and so each one kept her crazy-sounding secret to herself. Why would a person like that do such a horrible thing, we ask ourselves. By a person like that, we mean a normal-looking person, a person who looks just like us. We mean a person in a professional role, or an animal lover, or a parent, or a spouse, or maybe a charming someone we have had dinner or more with. And by such a horrible thing, we mean a negative act that is inexplicably bizarre, because there is no way, based on our own feelings and normal motivations, that we can explain why anyone would ever want to do it in the first place. Why would a smart, handsome, privileged boy like Skip want to slaughter small animals? In adulthood, why would fabulously successful Skip, married to the beautiful daughter of a billionaire, risk his reputation by breaking the arm of an employee? Why would Dr. Littlefield, a psychologist and the nicest person in the world, suddenly mount a brutal psychological attack on a recovering patient, and a VIP at that? Why would she, an established professional person, knowing she would be found out, make up a meaningless whole-cloth lie just to scare a young intern? These are the kinds of questions we ask ourselves when we are exposed to sociopathic behavior, and in most cases, we cannot come up with answers that sound plausible to us. Speculate as we may, we cannot imagine why. Nothing sounds believable, so we think there must be a misunderstanding, or maybe we have greatly exaggerated something in our observations. We think this way because the conscience-bound mind is qualitatively different from the conscience-free mind, and what sociopaths want, what motivates them, is completely outside our experience. In order to harm a mentally ill person intentionally, as Doreen did, or to break someone's arm, as Skip did, most of us would have to be seriously threatened by the person we were hurting, or be under the influence of a compelling emotion, such as rage. Performing such actions calmly, for fun, has no place in the emotional repertoire of normal people. Sociopaths, people with no intervening sense of obligation based in attachments to others, typically devote their lives to interpersonal games, to winning, to domination for the sake of domination. The rest of us, who do possess conscience, may be able to understand this motivational scheme conceptually, but when we see it in real life, its contours are so alien that we often fail to see it at all. Many people without conscience will behave self-destructively simply for the purposes of the game.
Stamp Man spent half his life in jail for the thrill, every few years, of making a few postal workers and police officers scurry around for an hour or so. Doreen gleefully put her own career at significant risk, just to damage her colleagues a little. These are behaviors we are not prepared to understand or even believe. We will doubt our own sense of reality first. And often our self-doubts are extreme. As an illustration, there was the remarkable public reaction, which continued for 30 years after her death, to a career criminal named Barbara Graham. In 1955, at the age of 32, Graham was executed at San Quentin for her part in the especially brutal murder of an elderly widow named Mabel Monahan. Mrs. Monahan, like Ingrid Bergman's murdered aunt in Gaslight, had been rumored to keep a cache of jewels in her house. Graham and three accomplices entered the house, and when no jewels were forthcoming, Graham, nicknamed Bloody Babs by the media, pistol-whipped the elderly woman, nearly obliterating her face, and then suffocated her to death with a pillow. Recorded at her execution, Bloody Babs' last words were, "Good people are always so sure they're right." This assertion was delivered calmly, almost with an air of sympathy, and as an effective gaslighting technique, it was a fairly good line. It caused many to doubt their own sense of reality concerning Graham and refocus the public's attention on her role as an attractive mother of three young children, rather than on her grisly behavior. After her death, she became the subject of emotional debate, and even today, against the weight of considerable evidence, there are those who maintain that Graham was innocent. Out of the public's self-doubt sprang two films about her, both entitled I Want to Live. The first starred Susan Hayward, who won an Oscar for her performance, and a 1983 television remake featured Lindsay Wagner. In both versions, Graham, the sadistic murderess, was portrayed as a poignantly misunderstood woman who was framed. Barbara Graham's last words, "Good people are always so sure they're right," has a gaslighting effect precisely because the truth is quite the opposite. In fact, one of the more striking characteristics of good people is that they are almost never completely sure they are right. Good people question themselves constantly, reflexively, and subject their decisions and actions to the exacting scrutiny of an intervening sense of obligation rooted in their attachments to other people. The self-questioning of conscience seldom admits absolute certainty into the mind, and even when it does, certainty feels treacherous to us, as if it may trick us into punishing someone unjustly or performing some other unconscionable act. Even legally, we speak of beyond a reasonable doubt, rather than of complete certainty. In the end, Barbara Graham understood us far better than we understood her, and her parting remark pushed an irrational but very sensitive psychological button in the conscience-bound people who survived her, the fear that they had made a decision based on too much certainty. Adding to our insecurity, most of us comprehend instinctively that there are shades of good and bad rather than absolute categories. We know in our hearts there is no such thing as a person who is 100% good, and so we assume there must be no such thing as a person who is 100% bad. And perhaps philosophically, and certainly theologically, this is true. After all, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the devil himself is a fallen angel. Probably there are no absolutely good human beings, and no utterly bad ones. However, psychologically speaking, there definitely are people who possess an intervening sense of constraint based in emotional attachments, and other people who have no such sense. And to fail to understand this is to place people of conscience and all the Mabel Monahans of the world in danger. How do we keep the blinders off? My daughter's fifth grade class had a field trip, and I was one of the chaperones. We went to see a play called Freedom Train about Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad. On the noisy bus ride back to school, one of the boys was picking on another boy, poking him and pulling his hair. The quiet boy, being poked, was developmentally delayed, friendless, I am told, and did not have a clue how to defend himself. Even before one of the adults could intervene, a petite girl seated just behind the two boys tapped the tormentor on the shoulder and said, "That's really mean. Quit it." The person who recognized this antisocial behavior and publicly objected to it was 10 years old and all of 4 feet tall. The boy she had spoken to stuck his tongue out at her and leaped over to another bus seat to be with one of his pals. She watched him go and then calmly resumed the game of rock-paper-scissors she had been playing with the girl next to her. What happens to us while we are growing up? Why do adults stop saying quit it to the bullies? The grown-up bullies are more powerful, but then so are we. Will this healthy little girl behave with the same kind of dignity and self-assurance when she is 30 years old and a foot and a half taller? Will she be another Harriet Tubman, albeit with a different cause? Sadly, given our present child-rearing practices, the odds are against it. We raise our children, especially girls, to ignore their spontaneous reactions. We teach them not to rock the societal boat, and this is a good and necessary lesson when the spontaneous reaction involved would be to strike out violently with fists or words, or to steal an attractive item from a store, or to insult a stranger in a supermarket line. But another kind of spontaneous reaction, equally suppressed by our conflict-avoidant society, is the ick reaction, the natural sense of moral outrage. By the time she is 30, the valiant little girl's ick, her tendency to respond, to rock the boat when someone's actions are really mean, may have been excised from her behavior, and perhaps from her very mind. In their book, Women's Anger, Clinical and Developmental Perspectives, gender psychologists Deborah Cox, Sally Stabb, and Karen Bruckner document the way girls and women perceive social responses to their outrage. Cox, Stabb, and Bruckner write that the majority of interactions they, girls and women, describe involve rejection of either the anger, the girl or woman, or both. This takes the form of either direct attack through criticism or defensive response, or more passive rejection, such as withdrawal and minimization of the girl's or woman's concerns and feelings. And based on her studies of adolescent girls, educator Lynn Mikkel Brown maintains that idolized femininity can dangerously endorse silence over outspokenness. To keep the blinders off, our life-enhancing seventh sense, as with most improvements in the human condition, we must start with our children. A part of healthy conscience is being able to confront consciouselessness. When you teach your daughter, explicitly or by passive rejection, that she must ignore her outrage, that she must be kind and accepting to the point of not defending herself or other people, that she must not rock the boat for any reason, you are not strengthening her pro-social sense. You're damaging it, and the first person she will stop protecting is herself. Cox, Stabb, and Bruckner argue emphatically that the requirement to suppress outrage at the other robs the woman of an opportunity to develop this kind of autonomy. Instead, as Lynn Mikkel Brown has said, we need to suggest the possibility, even under the most oppressive conditions, for creative refusal and resistance. Do not set her up to be gaslighted. When she observes that someone who is being really mean is being really mean, tell her she is right, and that it is okay to say so out loud. Jackie Rubenstein chose to believe her patient, Dennis, and not to believe her dangerous colleague, Doreen Littlefield. "It was a good moral choice," she said effectively. "That's really mean. Quit it." Though saying so out loud caused her to be viewed as a troublemaker by many of the less insightful people around her. As for the boys, in Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys, leading child psychologists Dan Kindlin and Michael Thompson record their concern about the frequency with which vulnerable fathers turn to time-honored defensive responses to maintain the fiction that father knows best. Parents, especially fathers, typically teach their sons to obey authority no matter what, and given the wrong cultural and political circumstances that have occurred with morbid regularity throughout history, this is a lesson that may well come with a suicide clause. That parents wish to foster a certain respect for legitimate authority is understandable and probably important for the functioning of society as we know it. But to drill children in reflexive, no-questions-asked obedience is to beat a horse that is more than half dead already. Obedience to apparent authority is a knee-jerk reaction in most people quite without training,
and to sensitize this reflex is to make our children hyper-vulnerable to any aggressive or sociopathic authority who may come along later in their lives. To everyone's detriment, obedience and the higher values of patriotism and duty can become indistinguishable motivations. Enhanced in this way, reflexive obedience can consume the individual before he even has a chance to wonder whether he himself might be the best authority when it comes to his own life and his own country, and long before he can ask questions such as, "Do I and my countrymen really want to fight and perhaps die for this external authority's self-interest?" Still, I believe we may now be standing at the edge of a modern possibility, thousands of years in the making. In the past, for stark reasons of survival, human beings truly needed their children not to upset any hard-won apple carts, not to question things too much, not to disobey orders. Life was physically hard and precarious, and children who challenged our authority might all too easily end up as dead children. And so, until recent centuries, we raised humans for whom moral outrage was an extreme luxury, and to whom the questioning of authority felt life-threatening. In this way, generation after generation, we were unwittingly set up for sociopathic takeovers. But now, for most of us in the developed world, survival conditions no longer hold. We can stop. We can let our children question things. And when they are grown, they can, without doubting their own senses, look the grown-up bullies in the eye and say, "That's really mean. Quit it." But what about those of us who are already grown? We who have had decades of practice in ignoring our own instincts. How can we avoid being gaslighted and allow ourselves to recognize the people around us who have no conscience? This is the concern addressed in the next chapter. It is an interesting question, with a rather surprising answer. Chapter 6. How to Recognize the Remorseless. In the desert, an old monk had once advised a traveler, "The voices of God and the devil are scarcely distinguishable." Lauren Isley. In my practice, one of the questions I am asked most often is, "How can I tell whom to trust?" Since my patients are survivors of psychological trauma, most of whom have been devastated by other human beings, this is not a surprising concern for them to have. On the other hand, my feeling is that this issue is a pressing one for most of us, even those who have not endured severe trauma, and that we all try very hard to assess the level of conscience that exists, or not, in other people. We are especially interested in the conscience quotient of the people we have close relationships with, and when we meet an attractive new person, we often invest considerable mental energy in suspiciousness over, guesses about, and wishful thinking concerning the question. The untrustworthy do not wear special shirts or marks on their foreheads, and the fact that we must often make crucial decisions about other people based on not much more than guesswork leads us to irrational strategies that readily become lifelong superstitions. "Don't trust anyone over 30. Never trust a man. Never trust a woman. Never trust anyone," are the most popular examples. We want a clear rule, even a sweeping one, because knowing whom to be wary of is so important to us. But these wide-brush strategies are ineffective, and worse, they tend to produce anxiety and unhappiness in our lives. Apart from knowing someone well for many years, there is no foolproof decision rule or litmus test for trustworthiness, and it is extremely important to acknowledge this fact, unnerving though it may be. Uncertainty in this regard is simply a part of the human condition, and I have never known anyone who got around it completely, except by the most extraordinary luck. Furthermore, to imagine there is an effective method, a method that one has thus far been unable to figure out, is to beat up on oneself in a way that is demeaning and unfair. When it comes to trusting other people, we all make mistakes. Some of these mistakes are larger than others. Having said this, when people ask me about trust, I reply that there is bad news and good news. The bad news is that there truly are individuals who have no conscience, and these individuals are not to be trusted at all. Perhaps an average of 4 people in a random group of 100 are limited in this way. The good news, the very good news, is that at least 96 people out of 100 are bound by the constraints of conscience and can therefore be counted on to behave according to a reasonably high baseline of decency and responsibility. To behave, in other words, more or less, as well as you and I do. And to my mind, this second fact is a great deal more compelling than the first. It means, astonishingly, that to a certain standard of pro-social behavior, our interpersonal world should be about 96% safe. And so why does the world seem to be so terribly unsafe? How do we explain the 6 o'clock news, or even our own personal bad experiences? What is going on here? Could it conceivably be that a mere 4% of the population is responsible for nearly all of the human disasters that occur in the world and in our individual lives? This is an arresting question, one that offers to overhaul many of our assumptions about human society. So I will repeat that the phenomenon of conscience is overwhelmingly powerful, persistent, and pro-social. Unless under the spell of a psychotic delusion, extreme rage, inescapable deprivation, drugs, or a destructive authority figure, a person who is conscience-bound does not, in some sense he cannot, kill or rape in cold blood, torture another person, steal someone's life savings, trick someone into a loveless relationship as sport, or willfully abandon his own child. Could you? When we see people doing such things, either in the news or in our own lives, who are they? On the rare occasion they are formally insane or under the pressure of some radical emotion. Sometimes they are members of a group that is desperately deprived, or they are substance abusers, or the followers of a malevolent leader. But most often they are none of these. Rather, most often, they are people who have no conscience.